at the end of March, or are we combining that with what time? We combined all classes for the semester.
For the whole semester?
Yeah, so okay. We were just required to use at least twice psych and at least this many times that class,
so
or whatever.
Have three you'll have to use.
Yeah, so.
Peds, women's health, and critical care.
Okay, but it'll be due at the end
that
of the semester.
That works for me,
yeah. Okay, and then we'll just send it to everyone that's involved.
Yeah.
Okay, is that going? Okay. Good. Thank you so much.
Hi, you're welcome.
Can I leave this up here?
Sure. You gonna give me a code so I can get into it?
I can leave it unlocked.
I'm teasing you. I'm teasing you. It's a lot. You can tell it's a lot newer than my phone. You're like,
do
oh
you
God,
have
are they
five?
Making that? No, I think that's what it is.
The five?
Yeah. I've had it so long, I couldn't tell you.
I had a five, and then I got a seven, and then I got this.
Yeah. And you got a crack in it already?
Well, it's just a screen protector.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah, because my siblings like to take it from me, so.
Absolutely.
I guess okay. I'll just go ahead and start it and I can cut it back.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's time to start, isn't it? I'm late here. I'm late. I've been looking for you here.
Me too.
Okay, looks like we need to get started. Good afternoon, Natchitoches. Do y'all hear me?
Miss Hill, we can't hear you online.
Okay. All right. Let me see here. Okay. Do y'all hear me? Okay, does everybody hear me now?
Can you hear us in Natchitoches?
Yes, I do.
We just need to hear y'all.
Okay, let me see what's going on. Sorry.
It looks like your screen may be muted.
Okay. Still no luck? Y'all don't hear me? How about now,
Nacken? Can you hear me?
Yes.
If you can hear me, raise my hand. We can't hear you on the line, darling.
All right, I'm working on it. Well, how? They can't hear me. Excuse me. Don't record that. Erase what I just said, okay?
I guess just whenever you get ready.
I'll hit that. All right, I'm trying to figure it out. See all them. Does anybody know anything about this? How to do this? Never had this trouble before. Oh, is that it?
I think you pressed that.
There you go. There. How about now? Do y'all hear me? Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. I had to get a student up here to help me. Okay. Apologize for the delay here. I have just a couple announcements I need to make, okay? Ms. Rogers notified me today that here on the Shreveport campus, apparently there's quite a few students that are delinquent in their TB. You know, technically you should not be in clinical if you do not have a current TB. So you need to go by and see Ms. Rogers. She can do them here. You don't even have to leave the campus to get it done. So please take care of that pronto. I can assure you if we arrive at B term and they're not done, you will not begin clinicals. So if you are delinquent on anything on your health form, you need to talk to Ms. Rogers and find out what it is, okay? By now, those of you who needed it should have received your learning contracts. If you have not received a learning contract from myself or your or Ms. Rieger or Ms. Hadle, you need to be sure and contact one of them, okay? I have the sign-in sheet. As y'all recall, at the beginning of the semester, I assigned who should be here on Mondays and who should be here on Thursdays. I think we've been a little delinquent in some of people not attending. Some will notify me in advance if there's a problem, and that's typically not going to be a problem for me to let you do it virtually. But technically, there's enough people in this class that I could require everybody be here Mondays and Thursdays because we have enough room for everybody. But I didn't do that. I gave the option, so if you're to be here today, you should be here today. Vice versa for Thursday, I will be checking it. I can tell you indeed, you'll be expected to attend each session face to face. So appreciate now that you're only doing it once a week. And follow through with that, please. Okay, so I think that's it for right now. So we're gonna get started. So today we are going to start talking about the newborn, beginning with chapter 17. Okay. Yes, here we go. So transitioning of the newborn. I think this starts on page 578. And we'll begin with, well, let's back up just a second. And let's talk about the transitioning. The transitioning period is considered to be the first 28 days of life. That's the neonatal period. Once after their 28 days, they become infants, no longer neonates. During those first 28 days, they may be referred to as neonates. So what we're going to look at is major physiological changes that occur as the newborn transitions to extrauterine life outside of the uterus. We're going to look at the vascular changes that take place, cardiovascular changes that take place from fetal circulation to extrauterine circulation, the factors that influence the initiation of the newborn respirations. We're going to relate the characteristics that predispose newborns to heat loss after birth, distinguish primary immunoglobulins that help strengthen the newborn's immunological system, and some other things. These should be listed in your textbook as far as the goals of that chapter. So the first thing that we'll look at is the anatomic and physiological comparison of the fetus and the newborn. This is table 17.1. Look at maybe at page 578, I'm thinking that it may be on. So the first hour is often referred to as a golden hour. The newborn's intrauterine to extrauterine transition is both dramatic and critical. And it occurs in four independent areas. Circulatory, respiratory, thermoregulations, and their ability to stabilize their blood glucose levels. All must successfully transition in order for the newborn to adapt to extrauterine life. It usually occurs within the first 6 to 10 hours, while some adaptations may take weeks to attain full maturity. So we're going to talk about these individually here now. So the cardiovascular system adaptations. They switch from fetal to newborn circulation. And this is one of those things I think, when you really think about it, it's already amazing how this baby has functioned in utero and how the systems have worked as far as that it's all provided by the mother. And you'll learn a little bit more when you get into peds and you talk about neonatal cardiovascular systems and how all of this really gets into play. So we're just going to briefly talk about them, and I'll save the detail for when y'all get into peds. So the switch occurs when the cord is clamped. Okay, and that baby takes its first breath. They change from placental to pulmonary gas exchange. The physical forces leading to increase the release of the catecholamines that are critical for changes involved in transition to extrauterine life. So remember now, I'm just going to tell you what takes place as far as really getting detailed about that. Y'all will talk that in peds, okay? But there's fetal structures, okay? We hit on these a few times that are going to make changes, okay? The foramen ovale, the ductus arteriosus, the ductus venosus, doesn't sound right, umbilical arteries and vein, okay? Now, if you recall, we hit upon it in antepartum how all of that is working just backwards of what you're used to in extrauterine life when it's being provided by the mother, okay? And now things have got to close, stop working as they have been, and become functional for extrauterine life. The heart rate may change, their blood volume is going to be different, and the blood components. And if these things don't occur, they can cause physiological imbalances, such as not getting enough oxygen to the brain. Over time, the ductus arteriosus, the ductus venosus, and umbilical vessels that were vital during fetal life are no longer needed and form non-functional ligaments. Think about that. All these things that were vital in the uterus, intrauterine, they just become non-functional ligaments. On page 581 under the take note, it says the transient functional cardiac murmurs may be heard during the neonatal period as a result to changing dynamics. They usually are considered to be benign. And one that you may hear that does sometimes take longer is the patent ductus arteriosus. And sometimes you may hear it there in the newborn nursery, and then the next day you may not hear it. So again, those first 28 days of neonates, they're not necessarily going to take action on that. You know, they may get an echo just to confirm that is what they're hearing, but as far as any kind of action, if it's one of those that are going to become a non-functioning structure, they're not going to do any kind of interventions. On page 28081, that's where that first box we were looking at that shows the changes from fetal to neonatal. So normal blood volume values, they're going to probably be a little bit different than what we would be used to seeing, you know, what you're used to hearing and seeing now as adults. Volume can be dependent on time of clamping of the cord. Recent studies indicate delayed clamping includes improving the cardiopulmonary adaptation, preventing iron deficiency anemia, improving O2 transport, and increasing red blood cell flow. Also, at least there's a 30% increase in blood volume for the term babies. The American Academy of Pediatrics and the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists opinions released supported delaying the clamping of the cord for 30 to 60 seconds. You know, if you've had an opportunity to see a delivery, you know, sometimes while the doctor's still holding the baby, you know, before it's ever handed off to the mother or laid up on the abdomen, they may clamp the cord. Well, now they're recommending lay that baby up there on the mother's abdomen, you know, give it up to a minute, and then clamp and cut the cord. Cord blood has been described as nature's first stem cell transplant because it possesses regenerative properties and can grow into different types of cells in the body. That's why you may also encounter, you know, some individuals that want the, you know, a separate sampling of the cord blood collected, and that they've maybe, you know, contracted with some sort of national lab or something to store that cord blood in the event it's needed at some point for stem cells. Not everyone does that, but it is something that is available out there. So again, on page, I think that was 582, here's the summary box that kind of goes over what takes place with the circulation. You clamp the cord. This eliminates the placenta as the reservoir for the blood. There's an onset of respirations. It causes a rise in the PO2 in the lungs and a decrease in pulmonary vascular resistance, which in turn increases pulmonary blood flow and increases pressure in the left atrium. And it goes on down telling you. I mean, all these things have been just opposite while the baby's been dependent on the placenta. And now once we've shut that off, it's gonna make it switch. Those different ducts are gonna start closing, becoming non-functional, and you're gonna have where you've had fetal circulation to be opposite of what we're used to now, where it comes in one direction and out the other, It was just reversed when it was fetal. So you decrease the pressure in the right atrium, which causes closure of the foramen ovale. This usually happens within minutes after birth, secondary to the changes in the pulmonary vascular resistance and increased left heart pressure. And y'all, like I said, y'all will go into this in more detail in pediatrics. So this little summary box, you might want to note that as something you'll want to go back to when you're in peds, just to be familiar with what's taking place with all of this. So again, with the increase in the O2 levels after the first breath and the increase in resistance, it decreases the vena cava return, which reduces blood flow in the umbilical vein, which causes it to constrict and become a ligament with functional closing. With closure of the ductus venous, that's just not right. I know I'm not saying that right. Venosus, it becomes a ligament also as a cause of an increase in the pressure in the aorta, which forces closure of the ductus arteriosus within 10 to 15 hours. Again, you will probably study in peds, or if you've had a chance, although I don't think y'all get to now because of COVID, being in NICU, that's one of the major problems they do encounter with prematures, is that ductus arteriosus doesn't close and they have to go in and surgically close it. It's not uncommon with your extreme premature babies. So the respiratory adaptations that take place, you have the initiation of respirations. Excuse me just a minute. We don't see a little record button, do we? Okay, it's going. Sorry. I just started recording. It's going to be a little delayed. Okay, so respiratory systems. Initiation of respirations. Adjusting from a fluid-filled intrauterine environment to gaseous extrauterine environment. This is where the role of the surfactant takes place. It's a surface tension-reducing lipoprotein that prevents alveolar collapse. This usually peaks at 35 weeks. That's why if somebody is in preterm labor and the time permits, and again, they're going to give them the Celestone so that they can increase the surfactant level. If they go into labor at 35 weeks or greater, they're not going to probably give them this surfactant because it's really already peaked in the baby's lungs. Respirations typically are going to be 30 to 60 breaths per minute. They'll be irregular, shallow, unlabored. They may have short periods of apnea, less than 15 seconds. They should have symmetrical chest movements. If the apneic episodes last for more than 15 seconds, this will require further evaluation if you see cyanosis or changes in the heart rate. That's why we tell you when you're getting their vital signs that you need to count for a full minute, because they are irregular, and you know, you may observe they'll be breathing, you know, it'll seem kind of normal, and then they seem to kind of take that pause, and then they get started again. So it is important that you count the newborn's respirations for a full minute. So events leading to the maintenance of respiratory function. So the normal transition, the initiation of breathing. On page 652, 653, you see figure 27-2 and 27-3 kind of show you how that takes place. The mechanical events, you have the delivery of the infant's face and the chest. typically during this time, again, was discussed probably antepartum, labor, and delivery, 80 to 100 mils of fluid that has remained in the lungs with the passage through the birth canal is squeezed out. At least 30 mils, not all of it typically, but at least 30 mils. We'll talk about a little bit later here with your C-section babies, they don't go through that squeezing, you know. Incision, although with the size of the incision, some of that I have observed in some C-sections, you know, when they take a little incision that's maybe 6 inches long and they're trying to pull out this 8-9 pound baby, oftentimes they end up extending it. But it's still not the slow squeeze that they get coming through the birth canal. So they don't express as much of that fluid from their lungs. And so it's not uncommon for your C-section babies to develop what's called transient tachypnea of the newborn. And we'll talk about that a little bit more here coming up. So typically, most of the fluid that's left in the lungs is reabsorbed within 2 to 12 hours after birth. So that's the mechanical event that's taken place. The chemical stimuli that takes place is when the cord is clamped. The PCO2 increases. It decreases the pH and the PO2 when the cord is clamped. Thermal stimuli occurs, that'd be the sudden chilling. Babies come from this nice warm environment out into this room. So imagine if you were in this room all of a sudden after being in a nice warm cocoon and you are all of a sudden pushed out into this room naked and wet, it'd be real cold for you. So the baby's response is going to be immediately to drop their temp and to start experiencing all these other problems that are going to go along with that, that we're going to talk about. And then the sensory stimuli. You know, we know that the baby hears some sounds into uterine. They know mother's voice, they may know dad's voice, you know, they're used to some stimuli. But all of a sudden now, they've got bright lights, people talking, maybe music in the background, you know, you hear these vents, you know, so there's all sorts of stimuli that now all of a sudden they're exposed to. So as a result of this, if there's problems during this transition, you may observe in the baby nasal flaring. They may make a grunting sound. When you're trying to count their respirations, you may see their little chest, you may see retracting, where it looks like they're trying to suck their stomach to their backbone. Their little chest just kind of caves in there. They may experience tachypnea. While we usually say, you know, greater than 60, certainly if they reach 80, respirations a minute, they are beginning to really struggle, and it's going to start then affecting some of the other systems. Or if you notice cyanosis, 50% of premature infants, this is those less than 30 weeks, will experience some form of respiratory distress. So, one of the questions here: a respiratory rate of 44 breaths per minute would be considered a normal finding in a newborn? Yes or no? Yes. 30 to 60 is considered normal. You'll want to remember that, okay? 30 to 60 is your normal respiratory rate for your newborn. So characteristics, now we're going to talk thermoregulation, okay? And hopefully you've encountered an opportunity when you have seen a delivery, been present for a delivery, and you see that particularly, usually the doctor's good about it, but certainly by the time the nurse can get her hands on that baby, you see them using the blanket or a towel or something and really start to try to dry that baby off as quickly as they can. They're gonna start with the head and really try to dry it because it's considered to be the largest surface on the newborn. Because their temp can drop quickly. They have thin skin, their blood vessels are close to the surface. They lack the ability of shivering because of limited stores of metabolic substrates, that's their glucose, glycogen, fat. They have limited use of voluntary muscle activity. Their large body surface areas relative to their body weight. They have a lack of subcutaneous fat with little ability to conserve heat by changing posture. They have no ability to adjust their own clothing or blankets to achieve warmth. And they cannot communicate to us if they're cold or warm. So it is up to us to be able to recognize and know what's going to contribute to a baby cooling off. Because a baby's temp may decrease 3 to 5 degrees within minutes after leaving the warm of the mother's uterus. So we have some mechanisms of heat exchange. You have conduction. Your textbook has the pictures showing you examples of the newborn in relationship to conduction, convection, evaporation, and radiation. Conduction is a transfer of heat from object to object when the two objects are in direct contact with each other. Convection is the flow of the heat from the body surface to cooler surrounding areas or to air circulating over a body surface. Evaporation is a loss of heat when a liquid is converted to a vapor. And radiation is the loss of body heat to cooler solid surfaces in close proximity, but not in direct contact. So, look at those pictures, kind of get an idea. Like I said, these are in your textbook. So, conduction, laying on those scales. So, oftentimes, you know, you'll see them, they'll at least put between the surface of the scales and the baby maybe a piece of paper to eliminate that hard, cold surface. Convection is you don't want to have your, say like your radiant warmer in the room. You really don't want it to be where it's in an open access as far as, say at the door, close to the door, and the door opens and the draft comes in and comes right across the baby. Or you don't want it by a window where it may also get it. So that would be the radiation if they're by the window. And evaporation is, again, if they're wet and that, as you know, their body is trying to get rid of that, then their temp's going to start dropping. So that's why we really try to get them dried off as much as possible. Because what occurs, thermoregulation is a balance between heat loss and heat production. Heat production is primarily through non-shivering thermogenesis. The heat loss is from the four mechanisms that I just discussed, the convection, conduction, evaporation, and radiation. There's a need for a neurothermal environment. So when you see NTE, in this instance, neutral thermal environment. Overheating may occur with a large body surface area. Limited insulation and limited sweating ability makes it difficult then for them to get rid of that temp. Cold stress, though, can lead to depleted fat stores. So if you have a baby that's, say, small for gestational age, they already are in the lower scale, and often with this is they don't have a lot of little fat storage. You know, these are your little babies that don't have those little plump thighs or little fat arms and everything. They don't have fat stores, so they don't have that to help maintain their heat. With that comes increased oxygen and glucose consumption, which then can lead to respiratory distress. The depletion of the glycogen will lead to hypoglycemia, pulmonary vasoconstriction, metabolic acidosis, jaundice, hypoxia, and decreased surfactant production. So you will probably, if you're in newborn nursery, and or you're making rounds out on the floor and you're checking the temp of the baby, you will see them, you know, if the baby's a little cool, you know, they'll ask mama to hold the baby. That's the best place for the baby to warm up, is if it's a skin to skin or even at least up against mother. You'll wrap the baby typically in two blankets. Some areas no longer use the hats to put on the baby's head, but it is an opportunity to help warm the baby up, is to cover the head with a hat. And you'll try those things before you actually take the baby back, perhaps, and put it into an enclosed isolate or under a radiant warmer to try to bring the temp up. The first measures would be wrap it in a couple blankets, get someone to hold the baby. Next, we have the hepatic system function. This is plays a role in synthesis, degradation, and regulation of pathways involved in metabolism of carbohydrates, proteins, lipids, trace elements, and vitamins. The hepatic system is considered to be fully active within the first 3 months. During this time, though, initially, the baby may develop what's known as bilirubin, jaundice, and it's based on the accumulation of the bilirubin. Because of the immature hepatic system, bilirubin is excreted through the urine and stool, but if it's not able to be processed appropriately through the liver, then it takes longer to get that excretion going on, and the baby will become yellow. We'll talk a little bit more about this, I think, on Thursday. The main two you need to be able to distinguish, though, are pathologic and physiological jaundice. Pathological is going to occur within the first 24 hours of life. It's usually related to some sort of a blood, not necessarily dyscrasia, but say like if the mother's Rh negative, and the baby's Rh positive. Or if the there's an ABO incompatibility. All of these will show up within the first 24 hours. Where your physiological may take, may not show up to the third or fourth day. And this is gonna be maybe a baby that was a forceps delivery and has a lot of bruising, or it was a vacuum suction delivery and has a lot of bruising. So, like I said, we'll go into that more in depth Thursday, I believe it is. So in the GI system, this is the development of the mucosal barrier to prevent the penetration of harmful substances. The physiological capacity of the newborn stomach is considerably less than anatomic capacity. And I know at one of our clinical sites, they used to have this little bag of, it had little balls in it that they would try to, in teaching the mother, it was to show them just what the baby's stomach content would be here initially. It starts out with that it is the size of a little more than a marble. So that initial feeding for the baby really shouldn't exceed 5 cc's for the stomach to adequately accommodate it and it not reflux back up 5 cc's. Then within the next 2 to 3 days, it gets up to be the size of a like a ping pong ball. Can take a little bit more. And probably in about a week, it's about, it can accommodate the size of a golf ball. So, you know, that's why when they feed that first time, you know, they don't want you trying to give the baby an ounce of liquid. Really? It shouldn't. They don't need 15. But sometimes that's what they'll shoot for. But it certainly is such, it should be small, frequent feedings. So, in talking about the development of the mucosal barrier protection, this is where you want the colonization of the gut from oral, environmental, and cutaneous microbes. And this is where particularly the breast milk provides them with that passive immunity. One thing to remember, it is not unusual, it's typical for the baby to lose 5 to 10% of its birth weight. They should regain this within the first 10 to 14 days. The cardiac sphincter and nervous control of stomach are immature, leading to regurgitation and uncoordinated peristaltic activity. Again, that's where you don't want to overload that stomach so that it can become used to having this volume in there. To gain weight, the newborn requires an intake of up to 108 kilocalories per kilogram per day from birth to 6 months of age. And we're going to talk diet and all a little bit more, too. Their bowel elimination, you want to observe the frequency, the consistency, and the type. It will start out as meconium. Have any of y'all had the opportunity to have to clean up a baby that has had a meconium stool? The green, tarry, stuck to it. You feel like you're going to scrub their skin off as you try to get that off the baby. Sometimes you may even see what looks kind of like a little mucus plug in it. And they'll say that's a meconium plug. Sometimes they'll pass that at delivery. So it's real important if, as the, say, if you're the nurse taking care of the baby, if you can't actually see the baby being delivered, then it's your hope your labor and delivery nurse is observing, because it's not unusual for the baby to have its first void or perhaps its first stool at birth. And it is important for us to know that. We need to be able to document within the first 24 hours of life that the baby has voided and has had a stool. That is our locale. Maybe out on the West Coast, they may even give it 48 hours before they begin doing any kind of diagnostics to see if there's something going on to prevent this. So we don't want to put that baby through that. So it's very important, if you are the newborn nurse, when you receive that baby, to ask the labor and delivery nurse, has this baby voided or stooled? And hopefully they have observed that. Or sometimes, you know, it'll be dependent on the doctor. They may tell you the baby's voiding now, or the baby is stooled. So this is how they usually look. Typically in the hospital, the most we're gonna probably see is the meconium. That usually takes place during day 1 to 3. As I said, it's green, thick, kind of tarry looking. And if it's been in that diaper for a while and it dries on that baby's skin, I take them to the sink and hold them under the faucet so I can try washing that off, because it can stick pretty good. You have meconium, then you have transitional stools. That's what you see there. Day four, these are kind of, don't know if it's gonna, it may look like kind of diarrhea. Typically they're kind of seedy looking. And you're like, oof, what is this? Your breastfed baby, theirs is gonna kind of be a yellow gold, mustard looking, loose, stringy to pasty, and sour smelling. Now this is gonna be, you know, they're gonna be at the house typically before all that takes place. Meconium doesn't have a smell to it, and typically neither does transitional. But once they hit about day five and it's really starting to get through the system appropriately, the odor moves in. For your formula-fed babies, theirs may look yellow, yellow-green. It can be loose, pasty, or it can be formed and have an unpleasant odor. That's those pictures you see, you know, of being the first-time mom, first-time dad. Doesn't have to be the first time even. But you know, they've got those legs and they're like, trying to. I had a sister-in-law when she had her first baby. She couldn't do it. I mean, she would literally throw up right there by the baby because she couldn't take the smell. She'd call me to come over and please change your baby's diapers. Her husband wasn't any better. But by the second one, they'd figured that out. Now everybody's wearing a mask, they maybe don't notice it as much. Newborns that are fed early pass stool sooner, which helps reduce the bilirubin buildup. So, question two. When assessing the stools of a one-week-old newborn who is being breastfed, which would the nurse expect to find? 1 week, breast baby. Green, black, tarry stools? No. Seedy, greenish, brown stools? Not really, no. Yellow, gold, loose stool? Yes. Yellow, green, soft form stool? Not so much with a breast baby. That's your formula baby. So, a 1 week-old newborn would be passing milk stool, which is a breastfed newborn, appears as a yellow, gold, loose, stringy to pasty, and sour smelling. Greenish black tarry stool would suggest meconium. Seedy greenish brown stool would suggest transitional. And a yellow green soft form stool would be more likely with a newborn who is receiving formula. So next we have renal system. There's a limited ability to concentrate urine until about 3 months of age. It has a low specific gravity. Again, as I said, an ATI, your ATI is within the first 24 hours of birth. Again, that is definitely the standard in our locale. As I said, some of your textbooks you may read, it may say 24 to 48 hours. But I can tell you, here in Louisiana, it's 24 hours. They want to have noted that a voiding has taken the place. And the first 2 days, 2 to 6 times a day, should have a wet diaper. Day 3 and on, it should be up to 6 to 8 wet diapers. There may be some variations in the appearance of the urine. It may have a brick dust, which is uric acid crystals. You may see some blood. This is really going to be more in the diaper, not so much that it's the urine. This could be from pseudomenstruation in your female. Infants, usually between, say, day 7 to 10, you may notice a little bit of blood in the diaper. Sometimes you've got to really be looking for it to even notice it. But if you see it, that is normal. I mean, we just start them out early. You know? They have that first pseudo-menstruation there at day 7 to 10. then typically they'll get a break for another 11 to 12 years. Or it may have an odor. If there's an odor, that's typically a sign of an infection or a metabolic disorder. So the immune system adaptation. Natural immunity is from physical barriers, chemical barriers, and resident non-pathological organisms. Acquired immunity is the development of circulating immunoglobulins with the formation of activated lymphocytes. It's absent until after the first invasion by foreign organisms or toxin. Newborn is primarily dependent on three immunoglobulins, IgG, IgA, and IgM. A major source of IgA is the human breast milk. So breastfeeding is believed to have a significant immunological advantages over formula feeding. It's thought to contribute to the colonization of the infant's gut microbiome. Integumentary system. Adaptations to provide a protective barrier between the body and the environment. The most important function of the skin is to provide the protective barrier between the body and the environment. It functions to limit the loss of water, prevent absorption of harmful agents, protect thermoregulation and fat storage, and protect against physical trauma. There's an accelerated epidermal development with exposure to air for all newborns. See, I mean, as soon as they arrive, they recognize they gotta toughen up. Neurological system adaptations. Development follows cephalocaudal and proximal distal patterns. The brain increases in size threefold during the first year of life. They develop an acute sense of hearing, smell, taste, touch, and vision. Touch, they have a sensitivity to pain and they respond to tactile stimuli. Their vision, they see initially 8 to 10 inches and they can track object midline or beyond 90 inches. The ability to fix, follow, and be alert indicates CNS is intact. Hearing is well developed at birth, and now you know it's one of our state requirements is to do a hearing screen on all newborns prior to discharge from the hospital. If they don't pass prior to that, they'll be scheduled to come back in typically within the first 6 weeks to be tested again. If they still do not pass, they'll be referred on to a audiologist or to an ENT. Because we know they can hear, and if there is a deficit, then you know they'll put them in hearing aids or you know work to identify just how much the deficit is. I had a niece that they identified. I don't think they were doing the routine hearing testing then, but we recognized when she reached close to a year that her speech had progressed to a certain point and then it never changed. She didn't learn new words. She wasn't saying different things. And my sister had her tested and they found she had a loss of eighth cranial nerve. And so it impacted her hearing. So at like 18 months, she was in hearing aids. And she went to a school that, you know, they had the audiologist. They taught sign language to all the kids because it was hearing impaired children in the classrooms. And before she finished the first grade, she transitioned into the normal. She was at the required, a level she needed to be, But, you know, they attribute it to the early intervention in that, you know, by the time she was two, she was going into a school 2 or 3 days a week that specialized in, you know, teaching them and all. So, you know, now they know it before they leave the hospital. So, you know, they certainly have made a lot of advancements when it comes to that. Their taste, they can distinguish between sweet and sour by 72 hours of age. Their smell, they distinguish between mother's breast milk and breast milk from others. Okay, well, that's interesting. Wonder why that mother's offering up other breast milk. But, and I said that, in NI, if we have a mother that is, for some reason, unable to provide breast milk or just unwilling to, you know, then I know in our NI, then we purchased it. We ordered it from a breast bank in Austin, Texas, and we called it liquid gold, which it was considered anyway, but you know, when you're paying anywhere from $18 to $20 an ounce, and you were ordering, you know, maybe, I mean, we would calculate it to the ounce how much we needed to order, you know, and add a little bit to it. But, you know, it would be over $1,000 at least once a month to order enough breast milk. And they could also add calories to it if we needed it to have more and all. So, and that's one thing. Like I said, we had to order from Austin, Texas. I'm sure with COVID, there's impacted as far as people being able to even, you know, do that now. But Oshner's here in Shreveport is in the works of establishing a breast milk bank here. So that'd be nice to have access here locally. Adaptations of the respiratory, circulatory, thermoregulatory, and musculoskeletal systems, indirectly indicating central nervous system transition. And that's where I said the ability to fix, follow, and be alert indicates CNS is intact. Their reflexes are also an indication of neurological development and function. It's the involuntary muscle response to a sensory stimulus. So we'll go over some of those reflexes that when you're doing your assessment of the baby that you should be checking. I think in chapter 25, table 25.1, pages 926 through 28 are a table of the reflexes and how you do them and what you're looking for. And it's a good table to review and to be able to recognize, you know, and know. Probably the primary ones that we look at are Morrow, Babinski. We look at their finger grasp, you know, if you put your finger out, do they, you know, grab hold of it? Rooting, this is typically if you draw your finger across their cheek, do they turn towards it, like they're rooting for the breast? Sucking, how they can move their head. And then you can also hold up a newborn and just kind of let their feet touch the surface, and you should be able to observe them kind of taking stepping movements. Those are reflexes that we're, when we're doing usually that initial assessment, once it's in the nursery and you have now the time to do all your measurements and your head to toe, those are some of the reflexes you would also be looking at. You're looking at, and this would be something when you're doing, we'll talk about the Apgar. You're looking at the resting tone. If the baby's just laying there in the crib, how are they laying? Do they have their arms drawn up? Do they have their legs drawn up? You know, are they just kind of flared out? You want to look and see when they grasp, or if you lift them up, what is their muscle tone like? Their motor activity, you know, if you startle them, you know, by doing a clap or a loud sound, do they, you know, throw up their arms and kick out their legs? You know, you're looking for those type of things. And like I said, that table on page 926 has some good examples and covers all of those. So, a nurse is assessing the sensory capabilities of a newborn. Which is the least mature sense at birth? Hearing, vision, smell, taste. Vision, that's right. Vision is incomplete at birth, with the ability to focus on objects only in close proximity. The newborn has an acute sense of hearing, smell, and taste. So, behavioral patterns. First you have the first period. Hold on, I think I went too far. No? Okay. Behavioral patterns. Hold on, let me see here. There we go, okay. The first period of reactivity usually is birth to 30 minutes, may last up to 2 hours. The newborn is alert, moving, and may appear hungry. Then they have a period of decreased responsiveness. This can be anywhere from 30 to 120 minutes old, where they have a period of sleep or decreased activity. And this is a good time for you then to do your initial exam. Their second period of reactivity is 2 to 8 hours. They awaken and show an interest in stimuli. So.
Did you say we usually would do our exam during the period?
Yeah, when they're kind of asleep, you know, then you can listen to their chest real easy. They're not crying. I mean, trying to get a heart rate when the baby is screaming and crying can be a challenge. You know, if they're crying and kicking and all, it's hard to assess. So if you can catch them when they're asleep, that's the best time to, for you to be able to do it and feel like you've really obtained, you know, good information. So, true or false, during the first period of reactivity, a newborn is quite sleepy. False. During the first period, the newborn is alert and moving and may appear hungry. So that is why, you know, again, with that golden hour is when we usually then also try to allow that time for the parents, mom, and dad to have that time with their baby, because the baby is awake and alert. And if it's a breast baby, oftentimes we can, you know, initiate the breastfeeding then also. So, orientation to behavioral responses. The orientation is how they respond to the stimuli. Habituation is the ability to process and respond to auditory and visual stimuli, and the ability to block out external stimuli after newborn has become used to activity. You know, they used to always say for the baby to sleep, it had to be, you know, in that quiet, dark room. Well, we know better. They can sleep right there in the family area with the TV on. You know, they develop that ability just as, you know, there's now, even as adults, you can be watching TV. I know personally for myself, the best time for me to get a nap is let the news come on. And within the first 5 minutes, typically, of the news, I have fallen asleep. You know, now, I really wanted to watch the news, but it puts me to sleep. I can get a good nap during that. And, you know, typically then, by the time the news is going off, I wake up. So, you know, we learn it very early that can, how to do those things. The motor maturity is the ability to control movements. We know at this time they have some control because you can watch with their head and all, but you also know you have to support that head. They don't have full control of it at this point. Self-quieting ability, consolability, being able to, you know, calm themselves down and stop. We can try with the
You know, they learn to respond with the social behaviors of the cuddling and snuggling, you know, or if you do the swaddling, you know, to help console them. Also, you know, there's the pacifier that can be used to help console them. So that covers chapter 17. So I can tell you that we're going to try to get 17 and 18 done today. I can tell you. Sure. You need to stretch for a second or anything. You can take about a 5-minute break here. I've got 2:07. I'll start back at 2:12. Any questions on chapter 17? Be familiar with those reflexes. Be familiar with the normal rates for heart rate. I don't know that I told y'all that, the 110 to 160. I'll tell it again when we get started.
With them being able to tell the difference, the smell between the breast milks,
mm-hmm.
I've noticed with my kids, like when they're on me, they'll root, but when they're on a friend, like
uh-huh.
one of my friends had a baby too,
right.
she was breastfeeding,
uh-huh.
they weren't rooting on her.
Oh, so yeah, there you go. They knew that. This ain't my mom.
Yeah, they're like, this isn't right. I had one who rooted on anybody, like, he didn't care. He's like, he tried to attach the guys anyway,
uh-huh.
he didn't care. He's like, give me food.
Give me something, huh?
Somebody's got food around here.
That's funny. Kind of like the dogs, how huh? that,
uh-huh.
you know, decide they'll hump anything or anybody.
Yeah, exactly. That was my firstborn.
He liked it.
Yeah.
He said, that's some good stuff.
I have a video of his dad holding him, and I was sitting on the edge of like the ottoman, and he
uh-huh.
was on the couch holding him.
Uh-huh.
And he like just launched.
Lunch.
It
so, I know that smell.
He wouldn't take a bottle if I was in the house.
Is that right?
Uh-huh. I mean, if I was out of the house, would he accept the
uh-huh.
bottle? A bottle of breast milk formula didn't matter. If uh-huh. I was in the house, he didn't.
Yeah. Know. How long did you nurse him?
I physically nursed him for 6 months,
good.
But he stayed on breast milk for 8 months because I had pumped him up and had
uh-huh.
him up. My second one I did a year.
Wow, okay.
My third one, she stayed on breast milk for a year, but I only physically breastfed her for
uh-huh.
like 3 weeks until she decided she did not want anything to do
with
that.
That. Uh-huh.
She just wanted the bottle.
Uh-huh.
She did not want formula.
Uh-huh.
She wanted the bottle.
Yeah. I had it at my great nephew, his wife. She pumped and gave it to the bottle. She never put her to the breast, to my knowledge. She just strictly pumped and gave it to her through a bottle. And it was like, well, you know, hey, it's breast milk. You
yeah.
know, I mean, that's not
baby
her.
My was a biter.
Oh.
She was just like, give me a bottle. So I was like, okay.
Yeah.
Here
we go.
Okay.
I know, I had a friend. She had a daughter. I can remember the last time we were able to all get together, I guess the year before last Christmas. It was over at my friend's house. Now, her boys were 2 and 4. I mean, they were talking and walking and everything. And we were in the dining room eating. And he came up to her, I don't know if it was the oldest or the youngest, one of them came up to her and yanked up her shirt and said, I want some nitty. And she just, you know,
well,
of course she was in a room with, you know,
yeah.
Nurses that were either NI nurses, OB
yeah.
nurses or whatever, but I just, even then though I thought, if he is old enough to walk in here and take you, then he needs to be learning how to drink from a cup and a bottle,
yeah.
you know? But it took her, she had a hard time weaning that second one. I remember seeing, she would post out on Facebook, please help me, how do I do this, you know? Because he wouldn't give it up.
With my middle one, I had to leave.
Uh-huh.
So
and that's what they did. They went away for the weekend, her
yeah,
and her husband.
Yeah, that's what I did. And he... because he had never had a bottle. Like I never did a bottle with him.
Right.
I was so sick of bottles by the time he came along. I just strictly breastfed.
And then to a sippy cup, huh?
Yep, right into a sippy cup with milk. I went
exactly.
away for the weekend, and his grandmother had him with
milk. I think that's what this girl did. She just finally, her and her husband went away for a few days, and left it to the poor grandmother to have to.
Well, they get hungry, they'll eat.
They'll do it, yeah, that's right.
And then when you come back, you have nothing.
Yeah. A break. Okay, we will get back. Get started again. So now we're going to start with chapter 18. This is management of the newborn. This is where we'll talk a little bit more in depth about, I think, the jaundice and things. So on page 600, throughout your book, you've seen the Healthy People 2030. Gosh, I can remember, it just didn't seem like it was long ago when they were planning and talking, you know, Healthy People 2020. And I mean, that, you know, started developing because it's like then they give 10 years out, you know, to meet these goals and all. And it was just like, 2020? I mean, that just didn't sound real. And now here we are with their plans on 2030. And with the newborn, the goal is to transition to occur during the first several hours with careful exam at birth, allowing for detection of anomalies, birth injuries, and disorders that compromise adaptation. The standards for the American Academy of Pediatrics is that all newborns must have a physical assessment by a healthcare provider within the first 24 hours. Recognizing, you know, that they're at delivery, even with C-sections now, typically, back when I practiced, we required a pediatrician to be present if it was a cesarean birth. Well, even during my practice, we got away from that. Nurses were being trained with the neonatal equivalent of ACLS, called neonatal resuscitation procedure. You know, they were being trained to intubate, to put lines in and those things. So that got the pediatricians out of being present. Now, if you're in a facility that has an NICU, and depending just on, you know, the gestation of the baby, you know, the labor unit may request an NI team be present for the delivery. Oftentimes, even then, that's still going to be an NI nurse and maybe a respiratory therapist. But if it's a very extreme premature baby, or they know there's problems, they may bring a nurse practitioner with them, or they may have the neonatologist with them. So they do have now access to having those individuals present for the deliveries if needed. So that initial assessment is usually going to take place in the birthing area to determine if the newborn is stable enough to stay with the parents. So what's going to take place is the nurse typically is going to be who receives the baby, and they're going to do the initial assessment of RAAP, R-A-A-P. If you're not familiar with that, it is respiratory, activity, perfusion, position and tone, they're listening for abnormal breath sounds such as ronchi, crackles, wails, wheezing, and stridor. An abnormal respiratory rate, They'd be considered to be tachypneic if it's greater than 60 per minute. Or bradypneic if it's less than 25 per minute. An abnormal heart rate would be considered greater than 160, although at that point you want to consider the activity of the baby. If they're kicking and crying and screaming and it's maybe 180, you want to let the baby settle down and check the rate again. If it's less than 100, according to our textbook, that would be considered abnormal. According to ATI, they say if it's less than 110. Testing purposes, we would accept either because the two books have different, you know, indicators. And so usually what's happening is, like I said, you know, maybe the parents have seen the baby, it's laid on her chest or whatever, the nurse has been drying it off and everything, and then she's going to want to take the baby, and they usually take it over to a radiant warmer that's in the room, and she's going to continue her drying off. She's going to be, as she's drying, she's looking at, he or she is looking at the baby, you know, to see, do they observe any obvious abnormalities? They're kind of looking to see, how is the baby laying, you know, is it putting his hands out? Are, you know, feet turned in? Do they lay out? You know, can do all, you know, just keen observation of all those things. Then they're going to listen to the baby, count that heart rate. They're going to listen to the chest, front and back, to hear. Do they hear? Oftentimes they're going to hear that wet sound because there is still that fluid in the lung. The question is it impacting how the baby's breathing? You may hear it. They may do what they call some chest physiotherapy, where they just kind of have the cupping, you know, and do a little clapping on the baby's back. Crying is what helps to express that liquid and get it out. So they will, initially the nurse is probably who does the scoring. We'll do the Apgar scoring, and I'll show you an example of it. You will, I can tell you on your exam, you will be given the scenario, and you will need to determine, you will score, do an Apgar score based on, you know, the baby presents with a heart rate of 120, is active, has a good strong cry, you know, moving all extremities, yada yada, and you're gonna have to be able to score it. That occurs at 1 minute and 5 minutes. And again at 10 if indicated, if it's still less than 7. On table 18.1 goes over the Apgar scoring in your textbook. I didn't write the page number down. They'll get the length and the weight. The vital signs, there's a table 18.2 has some of the quote vital signs you would expect to obtain. They may not necessarily here in the delivery room setting do a gestational age assessment, but somebody that's done them for a long time can just in doing that quick assessment probably really do a gestational assessment. She just may not be filling out paperwork, but she can kind of, looking at that baby and knowing what she's looking at, can say this baby is a term baby, or this baby is probably a little early, maybe 37 weeks or something. And then do a more detailed one once she's doing that complete head to toe. But she's gonna be, and I apologize to the males in the room, just, you know, used to seeing in newborn nursery, you usually see females. Now in NI, you have male and female nurses, but so I say she. They're going to be checking the skin out, the texture of it, the lanugo, that's that fine downy hair. Your older babies are not going to have as much. There's kind of a in between as far as with the preemie baby, who has just that really shiny, slick skin. And then they get their little lanugo. You see it on their back, typically, and their shoulders, little fine downy hair. The plantar creases, we're looking at the bottom of their feet. The more creases, if they cover the entire foot, you're looking at a term baby. A preterm baby, say less than 30 weeks, the sole of their foot may be slick. You may not see any creases. And then you may see, say, 1/3 of the foot as they get a little older. But your term baby, you should see creases over the entire surface. 2/3 or more of the foot. Breast tissue, you're going to feel, and you should be able to feel a little nodule type bud, and it's then you just kind of estimate the size of it. Eyes and ears, you'll want to obviously visualize that their eyes are there, are present. It's hard to do too much more. If you can darken the room and you kind of raise the baby up, they typically will open their eyes, and you can do the flashlight to look for the red reflex. Ears, you're just looking at the shape. You're looking at the location. Does the top of the ear line up with the canthus here of the eye? You know, is the top of the lid, is the top of the ear much lower? That may be indicative of a Downs baby. If you've ever noticed, their ears are low set. And what we're doing in reference to right here at the crease of the eye, where is the top of the ear? And it should be lined up with it. You want to know, does it easily fold and then bounce back? The older the baby, you can take the ear, fold it, and it will recoil instantly. The more premature the baby, you fold it, and it may kind of stick, and you have to push it back into place. You're going to check their genitals. The males, you're going to palpate the testicles to see the scrotum. You're going to palpate the scrotum to see if the testicles have descended. You may have to feel kind of up into the canal to see, do you feel them there? The female, and then you're going to look at the placement of where is the urethra. Is it at the tip of the penis? Is it located under downside? You know, so those all have to be observed. That would be hypospadias. You have to have a urinary consult then. And those babies would not be circumcised until that had been repaired. The female, you're going to observe for both the inner and outer labia. You should be able to see both. In your newborn, you should be able to see the clitoris. Most places now probably do not. We used to do, it was standard on newborns, and some places may still do it, is the initial temp on the newborn, we would get it rectally. This was to establish a core temperature and also to establish the patency of the rectum. Obviously, if you cannot insert a thermometer in there, then you might have an imperforate anus, and that would be require a surgical intervention. It's not really probably the standard anymore to do rectal temps because of the chance of possibly perforating. They do axillaries. But if they do by chance do that initial one, then moving forward, all temps are obtained axillary. Neuromuscular maturity, this is going to be looking at their posture. It's going to be doing those assessments that you would see when you do, if you use the Ballard screening tool. For gestational assessment, you're looking at square window, which is bending the wrist. Do you get a square window? Arm recoil, if you kind of lift up on the arms and you let go, do they recoil back? Popliteal angle is straightening out the leg and seeing then the angle that the foot goes. scarf sign is being able to pull the arm over. Does it come across the elbow to the mid-chest? Heel to ear. Can you take the baby's foot and pull up towards the ear? The more mature the baby is, the less likely you can. It's not going to come up as nearly as far as a premature baby. And then the Apgar scoring. Apgar was developed by Virginia Apgar, was her name. And she recognized that there were certain things we looked for in all babies to determine if they were doing initially all right, or were they perhaps in need of some sort of resuscitation. So they look for appearance, which is the color. Most newborns at birth, now we're doing this at 1 minute, okay? So we clamp that cord, now things are trying to get established. Circulation, peripheral circulation is usually the last to really get going well. And so your extremities, it's not unusual for them to be the hands and feet to have a blue appearance to them initially. So it's real hard to say at 1 minute that a baby, what you're looking for, the perfect score is 10. And at 1 minute, typically, truthfully, it would be a 9. But I can remember during my practice, we had a physician. Every one of his babies, it didn't matter if you were over there, you know, bagging the kid, they got a 10. They were perfect. They knew that's what the family wanted to hear. Oh, perfect. Baby's perfect. Had a perfect Apgar. No, they didn't. But, you know, that's how that went in those days. Pulse, the heart rate. On your Apgar, I think it says you score by less than or greater than 100, or it's absent. So you have your first column is 0, second column is 2, and the third column is 3. Oh, yeah, 1 and 2. I just say, nah, if we want 10 and there's 5, that won't work. You're right. It's 1 and 0, 1 and 2. Thank you. Until I haven't been in a delivery room setting and done those in a little while. So the heart rate, they want it to be greater than 100. The color, usually it's going to be pink with some cyanosis in the extremities. Or a 2 is going to be totally pink. Grimace, reflex irritability is how does the baby respond to if you're touching it, you know, does it kind of grimace? If you stimulate it, pull away, what does it do? Muscle activity, you know, if you pick the arms up, do they have some kind of a recoil to them, or do they just drop limp? And then respiratory effort. I don't think that's a score. That's just, are they retracting? Is it running? Those type of things going on. So, again, there is an example. It's table 18.1 in your textbook. So, heart rate, again, 0 to 2 is greater than 100 is what we want to see. Again, this is going to be at 1 minute. Respiratory effort. Are they apneic? They're not making any effort at all on their own to take in a breath. Are they very slow and irregular? Are they regular respirations? Which is a little kind of, they still may be irregular in appearance, but you're getting 30 to 60 a minute. Muscle tone is the observation of the extent of flexion in the newborn's extremities and newborn's resistance when the extremities are pulled away from the body. again, like I said, are they limp, flaccid? Is there some flexion? Maybe the arms are pulled up a little bit and they kind of give you some resistance if you try to move them? Or do they have good resistance with extension with quick return to the flex position if you try to extend them out? Reflex irritability is the flicking of the soles of the feet or suction in of the nose with a bulb syringe. Is there any response from the baby? Usually you're trying to get them to cry. Do they grimace or frown when irritated? Or do they possibly sneeze, cough, or let out a vigorous cry? Skin color is inspection of the trunk and extremities with the appropriate color for ethnicity appearing within minutes after birth. Are they cyanotic or pale? Do they have the appropriate body color but their extremities still have some acrocyanosis? Are they completely appropriate color pink on both trunk and extremities? So like I said, you'll be given a description of a baby and you'll need to figure out what the Apgar is. People struggle with the reflex irritability and that they're looking for a good cry. I'm pretty sure is what usually takes place. They miss that one and don't count it as a two. So the vital signs on the newborn. Temperature. Normal axillary should be maintained at 97.7 to 99.5 Fahrenheit. Celsius, 36.5 to 37.5. Heart rate. Now here, see, the textbook says 110 to 160, but earlier in this chapter it says 100. So even it contradicts itself. You want an apical pulse for a full minute. You would like to get the respirations when they're quiet or sleeping. Using a stethoscope to the right side of the chest and count for one full minute. Heart rate and respirations should be assessed every 30 minutes till stable for 2 hours after birth. Blood pressure typically for a normal newborn, neonate, whatever, they don't typically do in your normal nurseries. This is something that's obtained typically in NIs. But in the event it is, it should systolic should be between 50 and 70, with a diastolic between 30 and 45. I will not expect you to know that regarding the blood pressures, but you should be familiar with temp, pulse, and heart rate. Gestational age, I've talked about this as far as how we determine this. Gestational age is identified as preterm or premature, prior to 37 weeks gestation. Term, 38 to 42 weeks. Post-term or post-date is after 42 weeks. Post-mature is after 42 weeks of gestation with signs of placental aging. This kind of gives us a stage of maturity. Once we know what the gestational age is, we kind of then know kind of what we could expect from this baby in regards to some of its activities and all. So, starting with small for gestational age. This assists in predicting potential problems in planning care. The etiology is typically can be
the result of a mother with hypertension and the placenta's not function appropriately. Malnutrition or vascular complications. Some of these babies, in addition to being small for gestational age, it could be a result of intrauterine growth retardation. They could have symmetrical IUGR, asymmetrical IUGR. Asymmetrical IUGR may be the result of, again, some sort of a developmental problem, or it could be if the umbilical cord is perhaps causing some sort of constriction around a part of the body or something that we may have talked about any part of that it may abandon a part of the body that then has a growth restriction as a result of it. When you're looking on the percentile chart, your SGA babies are typically going to be in the less than 10 percentile for appropriateness of age and weight. Your AGA is considered appropriate for gestational age. This is usually going to be your kids that are going to be your term babies. They fall on the charting system between the 10th to 90th percentile. While you have your large for gestational age babies, these are often the babies of mothers with diabetes. They typically are greater than 9 pounds. On the chart, they're going to be in the greater than 90th percentile. Again, you can have babies that may have some malnutrition and vascular complications, but you know what? That copied over to be the same as the small, so that's not correct on this slide. Their etiology, like I said, is typically a result of babies of diabetic mothers. It may be just a familial thing. They've all had large babies and they don't have diabetes. The problems that they're going to encounter is typically maintaining a steady glucose. They're going to develop typically hypoglycemia. So talking about physical maturity, I kind of went over this already, but it's on page 603, 604. Looking at their skin texture, maybe again dependent on their age. Prematures are going to be thin, transparent. Your older babies may be kind of sticky. Lanugo is a soft downy hair. It's really absent in preterm. It appears with maturity, but it has really started to decrease with maturity. There's kind of a fine line, like I said, probably between that, say, 35 to 37 week that you may see a lot more on the baby. And then it starts to where you're just kind of seeing it maybe on the shoulders, maybe the sacrum, but they don't really have nearly as much. I talked about the plantar creases, what you want to see on the sole of their feet. Again, if you will look at the Ballard screening tool, it kind of defines as far as when you're doing that. You score these particular items, and the higher the score, obviously, then the more mature the baby's going to be. I've covered these things. I talked about these, what we're looking for, posture, how they hold their extremities in relation to the trunk, the square window with the wrist, that the arm recoils back, how far the knees extend, is the popliteal, can you straighten it out and the foot's up, the scarf is coming across the chest, and the heel to ear.
the more premature the baby is, the easier the foot's going to come up to the shoulder. Arm recoil is one of the measures of assessing a newborn's physical maturity. False. Arm recoil is a measure of the newborn's neuromuscular maturity. An example of an assessment of a physical maturity is the skin texture. So nursing interventions in the newborn period. We want to maintain the airway patency. We want to ensure proper identification, maintain thermoregulation, and administer the prescribed drugs, vitamin K and the prophylaxis, eye prophylaxis. So maintaining the airway, we want to suction. And how do we suction the newborn? M before N, remember that? Mouth, and then the nose. So if you'll just remember M before N, you can remember you are going to first suction the mouth and then the nose. And when you suction the mouth, you typically are going to take it and just ease it into the side of the baby's mouth, you know, between the cheek and the gum, and just gently suck, release the bulb, okay? You don't need to try to see if you can get the tip of the bulb down to the stomach, because all you're going to do is make the baby gag, and then they're going to really probably start recoiling up some fluid. So you can do it without vigorously doing those things. When you do the nose, again, kind of a gentle, put your finger on one snare and suction out the other, and then reverse, okay? Recent studies from the World Health Organization suggested using a towel to wipe secretions from the mouth and nose, that routine suctioning was not required. So, if you're in a situation out in the public or somewhere and you have to do a delivery and you don't have that necessary equipment, just grab a towel or something, wiping out kind of their nose, and just trying to wipe out the inside of their mouth. Can achieve, they say, the same as using a bulb. Maintaining thermoregulation, the first thing you want to do is get the baby dried off. You want to remove any wet blankets or towels from underneath the baby and put it down on a warm, dry surface. Medications to be administered, vitamin K, also known as aquamafitin. And we give vitamin K for what? To establish clotting. The eye prophylaxis is required by law. We use erythromycin, neonatal ointment, to cover the baby in the event the mother has been exposed to gonorrhea. So, when we are doing these physical exam, you know, it's advantageous, and that's why if you've been on a new, when you've been on the unit, it's not unusual sometimes to see the newborn nurse, if time permits, to come back and look at the mother's chart. She'll be looking at the prenatal record just to review the history, the mother's history. Hopefully y'all have had an opportunity to look at a mother's prenatal record to see all of the information that it provides. But the newborn nurse can look to see and know about her previous deliveries. Were there any problems? Are all those babies alive? Did any of them, you know, die for some reasons? She wants to know the mother's blood type. That's going to determine if this baby will need cord blood workup. if there's the potential for this mother to need Rogam. She's going to want to know what the mother's hepatitis. Well, I mean, that's a good thing to know, too. She's going to want to know what her strep, group B strep is. Has she been swabbed and tested for that yet? Was it positive or negative? And was she treated? If she wasn't treated, then hopefully time will permit that the mother will receive those antibiotics that she needs. She needs at least 2 doses on board, and those are at 4-hour intervals, I believe. If she doesn't, if she comes in and the mother, on her prenatal, it says she's group B positive, or there's no results on there, then they're going to give her those antibiotics. If they can't get in those 2 doses that's needed, then the baby's going to have to be cultured for group B strep and started on antibiotics until they have a culture report back. Because group B strep in the newborn can be fatal if not treated. So we talked about then the physical exam, anthropometric, and I'll be honest, I had to look that up. That was a new one for me. It is a scientific study of the measurements and proportions of the human body. So we're going to get those initial ones on that baby, which will be the length, the weight, the head circumference, and the chest circumference. Now, some people still also do the abdominal circumference, but that's not really considered to be one of those measurements that's going to make a difference proportionally. The head, you're going to want to measure. Typically, it's right above the eyebrows to get the largest portion of it. It should typically be between 13 and 15 inches. Should be approximately 1/4 of the newborn length, or about half the newborn length plus 10 centimeters. So 13 to 15 inches are 32 to 38 centimeters. The length, the average is 20 inches, 50 centimeters. The weight, the average weight in a newborn is considered to be 7.5 pounds, 3,400 grams. And y'all know how to calculate pounds to grams, kilograms? 2.2 pounds per kilo, or am I backwards? That's right, 2.2 pounds per kilo. So if it's 3,400 grams, 3.4 times 2.2. And you'll have to do a conversion, I can tell you, so. Get some practice with that. Chest is generally 1 to 2 centimeters less than the head. It should start kind of tapering down so that you have head right above the eyebrows, and then you get the chest, and it should be less. It should taper down. And then if you're getting the abdominal, it may be the same as the chest, or it may be a little less. You want to check their skin, turgor, pinching over the chest or the abdomen, and note how quickly it returns to a normal position. Figure 18.12 shows you the common skin variations. Those variations are like vernix, that's the cheesy substance that you're going to see on your newborn. Typically on your mature newborns, you may find it in the creases of their legs, behind their knees, maybe on the genitalia. You're not going to try to wipe it off. It will come off on its own. It has been a protective barrier in utero, and it's not intent to be wiped off. it will come off. You can hurt the baby's skin by trying to scrub it off, so don't. You may see the little stork bites, you know, the little red marks. Usually you'll see them on the nape of the neck. So it was an old wives' tale that's where the stork had picked the baby up and brought it to you. It was back there by the nape of the neck. The milia. Milia is just the little, looks like little fine little pimples that you see on the baby. It's also known as a newborn rash, or it's called erythema toxicum. You'll want to remember that. Erythema toxicum is a normal newborn rash. If they have it in their mouth, it's usually referred to as Epstein-Pearls. African American, Hispanic, or babies of Mediterranean descent may have Mongolian spots. These are typically found on the sacrum, the back, also in the genitals. They'll be darker. You may have observed sometimes, you know, black babies may be born very light skinned, almost to the point of just looking very pink, and you're wondering, is this a black baby or a white baby? Look at its bottom, because a baby of color, its scrotum or its genitals will be darkened. So that you don't look like an idiot when you go in the room talking to the parents, you take a quick peep if you're not certain. You can't necessarily look at the parents and maybe they're both very dark and expect that you're going to have a dark-skinned baby initially. It may be light-skinned and it will get darker, or vice versa. Their head, you're checking on, you want to palpate the fontanelles. Should have talked about that in labor and delivery. The anterior fontanelle is your diamond shape. Posterior will be your triangular. You want to make sure that you can palpate those fontanelles. They should, as a newborn, be soft, no tension. We'll talk about impedes. If you have, you know, a newborn come in, they're dehydrated, they may be sunken. If they're crying and really angry, they may be bulging, or if they have any kind of a cranial problem going on, or if there's been trauma and there's a bleed in the head, the fontanelles will usually be bulging. You want to check for variation in the head size. You want to make sure the suture lines are not fused. Okay, before I get into this part, we'll go ahead and pause and we'll pick back up under newborn physical exam. We will finish that up. That is probably the biggest part of our lecture, is examining the newborn. Chapter 23, I really just kind of hit on those spots that as a normal newborn you may encounter, not so much your high-risk newborns, from chapter 24. Those are both pretty, those we'll be able to get through and finish up. Because we will finish newborn on Thursday. You will have your exam on the Thursday that you come back from Mardi Gras. Although, don't plan on going to New Orleans and doing any celebrating, because they're shutting all that down. Not that you would unless you were practicing social distancing anyway. Okay, Natchitoches, thank y'all. Thank y'all, online people. And we'll reconvene on Thursday. Do you know, while we were sitting here talking about breastfeeding, it was being recorded and it was still off.
Oh, wow.